We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. And we're very pleased to have back on the program once again Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. And every other month he is on the program. It's always on a Monday. And we talk about general healthcare stuff. He has people of all ages in his practice. He sees grown-ups. He sees children. He births babies. He does all that kind of stuff. He's been good enough now to be a regular guest on show as an information resource. So just about since he deals with so many different sorts of things, whatever kind of question you have, you can give us a call, and he will do his best to help you. And of course, when we have doctors on the show, I always say this right up front. There's only so much that we can do because the doctor can't see you. We can't diagnose over the phone. But I'm sure he'd do his best to answer questions. And whatever's going on with you, whatever's going on with your kids, with people close to you, if you have some questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. And that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And we have the email. So if you'd like to send your question that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, David.
And Dr. Jeff, he comes in here, sits down in the studio, says, well, I have a patient who's in labor, and it's just possible that I just might have to jump up and run out some point. So if that happens, I'll turn to Jason Croft and he'll put on some music and we'll spend the rest of the time, or we'll go to the BBC. I don't know what we'll do. I will not be answering healthcare questions anyway. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, I'm sorry about the timing, but that's how it goes sometimes.
This is the joy of live radio. You never know what's going to happen. Well, I sat down when we do this. I sit down and I look for some things that I think I can ask you about. And of course, there's always health stuff in the news. I just didn't see anything that really seemed, I don't know, like I thought, oh, okay, here's something we really can talk about. Is there anything that's in the news that particularly strikes you?
Well, seasonally, yes. The temperature and humidity.
Oh, okay.
These, I think, are sometimes overlooked or forgotten or perhaps minimized by folks. But if you are outdoors and physically active when the weather is this hot and this humid, it is extremely important that people pay attention to their hydration, because even otherwise young, healthy people can suffer the effects of dehydration, but especially the ill, the elderly, and also the very young are obviously very much more affected by relative dehydration. And this can be significant because people can become quite ill. They can faint. They can pass out. They can basically hurt themselves when they fall down. So people really, really do need to pay attention to the weather and, if at all possible, stay out of the hottest part of the day, but really, really keep their fluids up.
Okay. And I'm sure we talked about this before, that really the best thing is water. Just
right.
Plain water.
Right. The old days of giving people salt tablets have pretty much gone by the way. It's really the amount of water that you get in that determines really your level of hydration. At a certain point, you can, in fact, lose enough sodium or potassium to be a problem, but that's pretty uncommon. And for folks who use some of the sort of sports water, Gatorade-type things, those are, you know, essentially mostly water, and that's the key part. But they do have a little salt in them as well, and that's fine.
Yeah, I suppose most people have enough sodium in their diet so that just they're not going to have a problem with having low sodium levels.
Well, that could lead into an entire discussion on high blood pressure. But it's been estimated, at least in the United States, that the average American diet has about 10 times the amount of sodium that your body actually needs to function. It's just that most of us, and you know, I'll include myself, think my food tastes better if I have salt on it. So, you know, we do have sort of an innate desire to consume it, but it's because we like it, not necessarily because we need that much.
And clearly we're taking in a lot of sodium that's not, well, I was going to say it's beyond our control. It's not beyond our control, but it's in stuff where we, and the phone is ringing. This could be, I'm hoping this is not the call. Oh, good. This is not the call that says he has to rush to the hospital. That we're getting a lot of sodium in prepared food. So it's not the case that we're sitting there with a salt shaker doing that too much. It's in so many things, and we're not really conscious of that fact.
Well, for thousands of years, salt has been used as a preservative, and in terms of, you know, meats, and now in canned vegetables and soups, it's put in both as a preservative but also as a flavoring. And you're correct. In a number of the processed foods that we eat, there already is a ton of sodium. So we certainly don't need to be, you know, grabbing the salt shaker at the dinner table and adding more. Yeah. In most instances, when we ask people, primarily because of blood pressure concerns or if they have excessive swelling, we ask them to cut back on their sodium, and we try to keep it to about 2,000 milligrams or 2 grams of sodium per day. And if you start looking at some of the labels on things, you'll be amazed at how quickly the amount of sodium that you acquire. So it's not difficult at all to get quite a bit of sodium in your diet without even picking up the salt shaker.
Yeah. So it seems that those are something that food manufacturers are starting to address and more in offering either just cutting down the amount of sodium or offering a low sodium alternative. And it says that. Now, I suppose then you'd have to actually look at the labels to see how much less is in the low sodium,
right.
How low can you go, depending on what kind of choices you make.
Right, and it would be very unlikely if you're buying processed foods that you're ever going to be in a range where your sodium intake is too low.
Okay.
That would be pretty unusual.
Okay,
unless you're on some type of medication that is depleting your body of sodium at the same time.
So, as you said, there is this this relationship between sodium and blood pressure. So, people who have high blood pressure, that's one of the things that you counsel them to do is you got to pay attention to the amount of sodium in your diet, and you got to cut that down. Why does it do that, and what does sodium do in the body?
It primarily facilitates retention of more fluid, which increases intravascular volume, which makes it a larger amount of fluid that your heart has to pump, and it works harder, and the blood pressure then goes up in order to do that. And there's probably pretty good evidence that you can drop your blood pressure readings by 8 to 10 points if you can cut back on your sodium enough. And so for people with mildly elevated blood pressure, in many instances they can offset the need for medication, at least initially, by simply cutting back on the amount of sodium they're consuming.
Blood pressure medication, I think for a while it wasn't the case that most blood pressure medicines essentially were diuretics, and so they were dealing with the fluid issue by essentially that mechanism, or is that's
what was originally thought, and many of the diuretics are referred to as quote water pills, and in reality the diuretic effect of the medication is simply a side effect, but is not
the
primary effect on blood pressure. It actually has some changes on hormones related to the adrenal gland that basically end up altering blood pressure, and the water pill-like effect actually goes away after a few weeks of regular use and is not the primary mechanism by which blood pressure is lowered.
Okay, I guess I have this feeling that at least there was a point where people were taking these kind of medications that seemed to be a sort of an unpleasant side effect. And
in fact, it usually goes away.
No, but it does go away. Okay.
It usually goes away if people continue to take it. And that class of medications is quite effective and is often used in combination with other blood pressure medications as well. It tends to work very well with others.
Okay. We have a caller in Indiana. We'll talk with them. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering if you could talk about, around, or of the A1C test. For a while, when I first found out I was type 2, my doctor almost made it liturgy. You need to get it down to 6 and even lower if possible. That's all stopped now, and she's fairly happy with just a decimal drop. I'm hovering around like the 6.1, 6.2. And as it's not talked about anymore, and I happened to mention that to a friend, he says, well, of course. And something to the fact that there were some tests done that over a period of time where people had, I don't know how low, but they were in the 5s at least, and found out the increase in stroke and some other things was altered higher instead of lower, what you would think. And I was wondering if you, as a general practitioner, who would be the first one perhaps to come across that in a patient, could give just a short talk about these ups and downs in regards to tests. You almost talked about in terms of the salt with the salt pills and things. I wonder if you could say something about that. Thank you.
I'd be happy to. The caller's referring to a blood test that's often abbreviated A1C, and it stands for glycosylated hemoglobin, and is an indicator of how much sugar has been floating around in the bloodstream for the last 2 or 3 months, as opposed to the usual blood sugar test when people think about, you know, taking a drop of blood from their finger and putting it in the meter. That tells us what your actual blood sugar is at that particular moment. But your blood sugar actually changes from hour to hour, day to day, depending on what you've eaten, how much you've eaten, how much you've exercised. Given the body's physiology, over time, there's a certain amount of sugar that's always in the bloodstream. And if that is an average or normal amount of sugar for a given individual, normally their A1C, which measures this sort of average amount over the last 2 or 3 months, is usually less than 6.5. And this would correspond to somebody who has a normal fasting blood sugar at that moment of somewhere between 80 and 100. So if your blood sugar, when you check it and you haven't eaten, is between 80 and 100, we would expect your A1C, reflecting your blood sugars over the last couple of months, to be less than 6.5. So most non-diabetic patients have numbers that are significantly less than that, sometimes in the fives. Okay. What has been looked at over many, many years is if you take diabetic patients and you look at their long-term blood sugar control, if they have consistently kept their A1C under 7, they tend to have fewer long-term complications. They have less eye problems. They have less heart problems. They have less kidney problems. They have fewer amputations of their toes and their feet, which are all long-term complications of diabetes if it's not well controlled. And there are good studies that show that diabetics who have kept their blood sugars well controlled have fewer of these potential complications, which is why physicians make an effort to try and keep their patients' blood sugars well controlled, because they're really trying to prevent those long-term complications. What the caller was referring to was a study done fairly recently where they took patients and said, well, gee, if keeping your blood sugar down in a reasonable range is good, then maybe pushing it down even farther would be better. And that just did not turn out to be the case in patients who already had diabetic complications. So there was no additional benefit to trying to drive the A1C below 6 when, in fact, below 7 was adequate. And so what was considered a method of really, really tight control of diabetes basically has been shown not to be beneficial in patients who already have long-term diabetic complications. Now, whether that will turn out to be the case in individuals who don't yet have complications kind of remains to be seen.
Okay. Well, I hope that that helps the caller. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Dr. Jeff Swearn is our guest. He works in family medicine at Carl in Urbana. And every other month on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour, he's here and we do this show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. So if you've got questions, you can give us a call. There are a number of things that are done to check people's blood sugar. There often people, as a routine kind of part of physical, may have a fasting blood sugar check. So you don't eat for a period of time, then you go over there and they draw blood and they check it. People who have diabetes check periodically. You know, they may check several times a day just by doing the thing that you said, doing the finger prick and taking a little drop of blood and putting it into a meter that shows you. There's also a thing that sometimes people do when you and you have to you go into, you know, wherever you get your health care because it takes a little while, where they give you something, I guess it's something that's got lots and lots of sugar in it. You say, okay, drink this. And then you kind of got to sit there for a while because then for a period of time that at regular points, they take blood just because they want to see what, you know, what happens to your blood sugar level over that period of time. Why do you do a test like that? What does it tell you?
What's referred to as a glucose tolerance test is basically a diabetes stress test. You're dumping in enough sugar into somebody's system to see if their pancreas in particular can respond and produce enough insulin to appropriately bring that sugar level back down. What normally happens is there's a certain amount of insulin in our system keeping control of our blood sugars. And when we eat and we absorb a lot of extra nutrients, and sugar included, our body kicks out additional insulin and brings that sugar back down. So for a brief period after eating, everybody's blood sugar goes back up. But it shouldn't go too high, and it shouldn't take too long for it to come back down into the normal range. And that would be somebody who's not diabetic. In a diabetic individual, what happens is their response to either food or glucose, the orange stuff that they give them to drink for the test, is that their blood sugar goes way high and takes a much, much, much longer time to come back down to normal, if it ever comes back down to normal. It may not. If they have really bad diabetes. So in the past, this was commonly used as a screening test to check for diabetes. With the newer tests, we don't use this nearly as much anymore. Between a fasting or random blood sugar and a A1C test, we can usually figure out pretty easily whether somebody's sugars are consistently high or not. The one time where the glucose tolerance test is still used fairly commonly is actually during pregnancy. And what's called gestational diabetes is a form of diabetes that comes on during pregnancy. And for that, we will in fact do a glucose tolerance test if we have suspicions about diabetes during pregnancy.
Yeah. I would think that might possibly be a little risky, although I guess maybe if you're already at the hospital, maybe that's okay, that maybe you wouldn't want to intentionally spike somebody's blood sugar like that, or maybe it's just you have a pretty good idea what it's going to be and that it's not necessarily going to be a problem.
The short-term effect of an elevated blood sugar is pretty much nil. It's the long-term effect of chronically elevated blood sugars that
That's
really causes the damage. One of the things we try to talk to patients about relative to diabetes is that there's a lot of emphasis on blood sugar, but only because it's what we can easily measure. In the long run, diabetes is really a disease of small blood vessels. Ultimately, those blood vessels get damaged as a result of the biochemical changes associated with elevated blood sugar. But we don't have a very good test to measure what's going on in your small blood vessels. But what we do have is the way to monitor your blood sugars. And over a long period of time, there's a definite correlation between how high your blood sugars have been and how much damage your blood vessels suffer. So we're basically using the blood sugar as a stand-in for what ultimately happens to people's blood vessels. In the short run, having an elevated blood sugar doesn't usually make people feel bad. Now, an excessively low blood sugar will, in fact, make people feel bad. So there many individuals who've ever experienced a really low blood sugar will do a lot to avoid that again, and they're willing to let their blood sugars run high even though the long-term effect isn't going to be good for them.
Well, I guess, and that's why they always refer to diabetes as the silent killer or the silent problem, because there's no really, you can have high blood sugar and not know it. There's not, you're not going to have any symptoms, so you're not going to feel bad.
The classic symptoms when your sugar is too high is people urinate frequently. All the sugar going through your system, a bunch of it ends up in the urine. It pulls more fluid out, so they're urinating frequently, and then consequently they get thirsty. Mm-hmm. So the person who says, "Gee, all of a sudden I'm drinking a lot and peeing a lot, and oftentimes feels hungry because their blood sugars are fluctuating considerably," those are kind of the classic symptoms of somebody with diabetes. But you are correct. There are a lot of people running around with elevated blood sugars who simply don't know it and aren't aware of it because they don't have a lot of physical symptoms.
All right. To call here, someone in Champaign. We'll talk with them next, and they're on line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a question about diabetes 2 and a person who might have, as I do, an A1C of 5.8, but who now is having a fasting blood sugar test that's running around 140, which is about what it runs for the rest of the day. What causes that high fasting?
This is one of the confusing parts for many patients, even those who've had diabetes for a long time. Part of the process of having diabetes involves more than just what your blood sugar does in response to eating. As I mentioned before, in response to eating, the blood sugar goes way up and takes a long time to come down, so your average blood sugar over that course of time is significantly higher than a non-diabetic. But the other thing that many patients don't understand is they say, "Gee, I've been fasting for 14 hours. I haven't had a thing to eat. How can my blood sugar be 140? And the answer is, part of the diabetic process is that your liver inappropriately kicks out sugar into your system. It's not supposed to do that when it's the wrong time. But in the diabetic, one of the pathologic processes going on is the fact that the liver is releasing stored sugar into your system. Even though you haven't eaten, even though you haven't done anything, quote, wrong, your blood sugar is still too high. And that's where medication comes into play. Different types of medications for diabetes work at different points in the process of regulating blood sugar, and some of the medications used help modify that inappropriate release of sugar from the liver.
So if I got up at 3 in the morning and ate a hard-boiled egg, would that make a difference?
It would simply make your sugar level higher than it would have been otherwise.
Otherwise, okay. I have another, I guess it's more a comment than a question, and that is that I have known in the past someone who has diabetes 2 and who does not recognize when their glucose is low enough so that they end up in the emergency room regularly.
Yeah.
Is it possible that there are persons who really cannot, even after years of experience, distinguish the fact that they're about to pass out?
If their diabetes has been sort of bad enough, long enough, that they are starting to develop what we call neuropathies, then yes. Part of that sort of early warning system that relies on our nervous system can in fact be damaged, and it becomes much harder for those individuals to have the physical feelings associated with low blood sugar, and they may not be aware of it. But this is usually somebody who's had long-term, oftentimes poorly controlled diabetes if they've gotten to that point.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you. And again, our guest this morning, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. If you have questions about health, this is the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month on a Monday. And the idea is that it's an opportunity that you can ask whatever health questions you have, and the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu.
Just a comment here, David. Mm-hmm. Seeming incidence of diabetes is skyrocketing in the United States, and one of the fastest growing groups is, in fact, children, and it seems to be tied directly to the same problem that everybody else has been talking about, which is obesity. And part of the physiology here is that in our body, our fat cells, relatively speaking, are resistant to the effects of insulin. So in many type 2 diabetics, where weight is an issue in their diabetes, it's not because they don't have enough insulin. If you measure the actual amount of insulin in their system, they have plenty. It's just that it's not very effective at getting the blood sugar out of the blood and into the cells because, mm-hmm. in particular, fat cells resist that effect. Okay? Mm-hmm. So in many instances, significant weight loss can majorly improve somebody's diabetic control simply by increasing the sensitivity of their own body to the effects of their own insulin. And in many, many instances, the basic building blocks of diabetes care are enough diet and enough exercise to get your weight down. That in and of itself is probably the single most important thing that people can do for type 2 diabetes. Now, in the type 1 diabetic, they simply don't have any insulin, and that's not the issue. They have to take insulin because they don't have it. But the type 2 diabetics actually have plenty of insulin. It's just not very effective. And as they lose weight, it will become more effective. And the need for medication can go down dramatically. In individuals who have basically made the effort to lose the weight, I have a number of patients who've gone off their medication entirely because they can now control their blood sugars through their own physiology.
Mm-hmm. Somebody like that, what's the prognosis over the long term? Isn't there age, doesn't it sort of play a role in this too, so that even somebody like that, it's possible sometime later they might require medication again?
They may indeed. We know that family history drives a fair number of underlying genetic metabolic pathways. We know that age basically reduces the effectiveness of some of these natural ways of controlling sugar. So yes, it may be. But in the meantime, they're not spending a fortune on medications. They're not subject to side effects of medications. And they're probably doing their blood vessels a world of good by keeping their sugars
sure.
down.
And you said earlier that essentially over the long term, the problem with diabetes was it was a disease of small blood vessels. That must be why it is that you see the complications that you do, like blindness and like problems with the extremities. I guess is that because that's where you find
a lot of small
blood vessels.
You got it. That's exactly right. Diabetes is probably the either number one or number two cause for amputations in the United States. Those usually be initially toes and then feet and then legs. It's number one or two cause of basically preventable blindness in the United States because of damage to the blood vessels in the back of the eye. It's got to be the leading cause of kidney failure, the need for dialysis, the need for renal transplant. Again, the small blood vessels that supply an organ that has a big active blood supply. And the same process with small blood vessels in terms of those that feed the heart, the incidence of heart disease is much higher in diabetic patients.
Okay.
And that's ultimately what's trying to be prevented by controlling the blood sugar.
Line one, we have someone here in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hi.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing the theme, I am a type 2 diabetic. Through weight loss and diet, I'm comfortable where I've gotten to. The one issue I'm having is high blood sugar in the morning. My A1C, I've gotten it down to about 6.7, but I'm still reading 140, 150 in the morning, and my doctor has prescribed metformin, and the metformin has not helped that morning reading at all. And is there anything that I can do naturally or diet-wise that might help that morning reading?
If you can, let me ask you this. Is your weight now to the point where your BMI is under 25?
I'm still overweight and need to continue working on that. So it's still an issue.
Okay. Physiologically, that's probably the single best thing that you can do. In that you will enhance your own body's natural effectiveness of insulin. But as we mentioned just before, part of the diabetic process is, in fact, that inappropriate release of sugar from the liver, which is occurring overnight, which is why your blood sugars are high in the morning, even though you haven't eaten. Now, through a combination of, you know, diet, exercise, weight loss, and whatever other medications you're on, you have managed to control your blood sugars the majority of the day, and you've gotten your A1C under 7, which is, in fact, the goal. So in that respect, you're doing very, very well. Additional improvement in your A1C may, in fact, come from controlling what's happening with your blood sugars then at night. And a combination of sometimes either oral medication, or this is oftentimes where an evening dose of insulin is given to help control what's being kicked out overnight. So you still have some other both pharmacologic options, but also physiologic. So if you can get your weight down, that's probably the thing that would help the most.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just because of the concerns that you've talked about of the rising incidence of diabetes and about the fact that we're starting to see more type 2, what we used to call adult onset, we're seeing that in
children.
In children.
Yes.
Has, and I don't know if in the past it was routine to check kids' blood sugar, you know, at what point as part of a regular physical that mm-hmm. you started to do that. Are you
it was doing not. It was not. But interestingly enough, there's been enough concern about this that the standard school physical that children have to have completed when they enter into the school system to begin with, and then at sixth grade, used to be fifth grade, but they changed it here recently, you now need a sixth grade physical and a ninth grade physical when you go into high school. There's actually a place on the form now that says, is the patient's BMI greater than the 85th percentile for their predicted age? Is there a family history of diabetes? Do they have any signs or symptoms that could be potentially diabetic related? And are they at risk? And so as part of the entrance into school examination, that's something physicians are having to address. And in children, it's not so much that we're going to do blood sugar testing on absolutely everybody all the time, but I think it's the opportunity to sit down with the child and their parents and say, okay, this is somebody whose BMI, body mass index, is inappropriate for their age. They're basically either overweight or they're too short. And I always give my patients the option. And children, fortunately, can indeed take advantage of the option of getting taller. Most of my adult patients can't.
Yeah.
So in children, the usual approach to weight issues is not necessarily weight loss. It's, okay, let's get rid of the crappy snacks and the junk calories, and let's have your weight remain stable, and we're going to wait for you to get taller. Hmm. And over time, if the weight remains stable but the height goes up, then the BMI will then start to fall back into the normal range. So in children, you don't want to necessarily stunt their growth by putting them on a calorically restricted diet to the point where they're losing weight. But you do want to get rid of the crappy calories that really don't provide any nutritional value, and then wait for their height to even them out. And so in that particular sense, I think that little series of questions on the school forum is a good opportunity for physicians, children, and parents to talk about, okay, what are you eating? And just as importantly for children is, and how active are you? In sort of days gone by after school, kids went out to play. And that was usually outdoors, you know, whether it was baseball or soccer or just tag, you know, they were literally running around, and now they come home and sit down at the video console, and you're not burning up too many calories just flipping your thumbs. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
Between the video games and just TV in general, kids are a lot less physically active than they used to be.
Yeah. And just you've used the term BMI a couple times. Just maybe there are some people who are not sure what that is. It's a way of taking a person's height and their weight and running it through a little mathematical formula and coming up with a number. And that it seems like it's now a little bit more reliable kind of way of determining is somebody at an optimal or healthy weight or not.
And if you're between 20 and 25 on your BMI, there's probably no significant medical problems associated with that combination of height and weight. If you're between 25 and 30 on your BMI, you are considered overweight. And losing a few pounds wouldn't hurt anybody in that particular category. Over 30 is, in fact, what we consider to be medically obese, and there are medical consequences associated with that type of excess weight. Beyond 40, the term morbidly obese is used, and because there is significant morbidity associated with that kind of weight. And it's those folks with BMIs over 40 where we actually start to discuss surgical options. Mm-hmm. These are folks who, from a medical standpoint, from an insurance standpoint, their insurance company will say, gee, yeah, we will consider paying for weight loss surgery, given that your BMI is over 40. We'll even consider a BMI of 35 and above if there is another disease process present that is being significantly adversely affected by the weight. And that may be their diabetes, it may be their cholesterol, it may be their blood pressure. So the surgical options are becoming more common because some of the surgical techniques have improved to the point where it's not as big an operation as it used to be. And that makes it a better or more reasonable choice. But even folks who undergo surgery afterwards are going to still have to pay attention to their diet and exercise regimen. So this is not the silver bullet where you just, you know, give somebody an operation and then tell them that they can eat whatever they want thereafter, because that is truly not the case.
All right. Well, again, other questions? We have about 10 minutes in this part of Focus. It's our monthly show, or every other monthly show we do, that we call Talk with the Family Doctor. And Jeff Swearingen is our guest. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. And the questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. And for people who are, if you have internet access, there are a lot of BMI calculators, places that you can go. Mm-hmm. So if you want to know what your BMI is, you have to know your height and your weight.
Right.
But if you got those two numbers, you can plug it in there, and it will tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, because of the concerns about diabetes, that we have a category that didn't exist before, or I don't remember having heard people talk about it before a few years ago, and that is something referred to as pre-diabetes, which I guess that means that, you know, based on certain parameters, you can say to somebody, "You're on the road."
Right.
Let's see if we can do something about this right now before you actually get to the point where we say that you're diabetic.
Right. And the reasons behind this is the fact that long term, again, if diabetes isn't recognized or if it's not well managed, you're going to end up with all those end stage complications. And so the question now is how early can we intervene and make a difference? And so the numbers previously used to diagnose diabetes are being pushed downward. Our own laboratory is an example. In the past, up to 110 for a fasting blood sugar was considered normal. But again, normal was based on, well, what's the average in the population? Normal wasn't defined as necessarily being healthy. Mm-hmm. If you have a room full of 300-pound people, the average weight is 300 pounds. That is statistically normal, but it may not be healthy. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so a lot of the numbers that we have used in the past for both blood pressure, for cholesterol, blood sugar, were simply based on population studies. But if you look at the United States, this is a population with an inordinately high rate of cardiovascular disease. So we weren't picking a healthy population to calculate what our normal healthy numbers should have been. And so numbers for blood pressure, numbers for cholesterol, numbers for blood sugar have all been pushed down to match the group of patients that have the lowest cardiovascular risk, not just the average or, quote, normal risk in the United States.
Hmm. Well, so you've got somebody who you think is at risk, who's in this pre-diabetic state. So we talked earlier about weight. Is that the very first thing that you're going to
Absolutely the first at? Thing. This pre-diabetic state is probably that individual whose fasting blood sugar is a little over 100, which is now outside the normal healthy range, but below 125, the point at which we say, gee, that fasting blood sugar is the same as somebody who has diabetes. So we have a large group of people whose fasting blood sugars fall somewhere between 100 and 125. They're not normal, or at least not according to the new numbers on our lab, yet they don't meet the definition for diabetes. So these are folks who, depending on what they do in terms of aging, family history, but most especially weight, may either drift upwards into the diabetic range, could potentially come down into the normal range, or may just sort of cruise along somewhere in between.
Well, let's we got a caller here, and they are in Urbana. Let's talk with them. Line one, hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about diet or make a comment about it, because many people think, well, if I cut back on my sugars, then I won't have so much, you know, risk of getting diabetes. But starches, you know, are a serious problem too. So is a low-carb diet good for people in the pre-diabetic stage or diabetic state, you know, already been diagnosed with diabetes?
The answer to your question is yes. And you point out exactly the problem. Many people recognize the donut and the cookie as, you know, something with a lot of sugar and probably something they ought to avoid if they are, you know, concerned about either being pre-diabetic or being diabetic. But you are very, very correct in that simple carbohydrates, the white bread type things, as soon as you eat them internally, they basically are converted to sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And so people will say, well, gee, you know, I had a couple pieces of bread. It wasn't, quote, sweet. So that should be okay. And the answer is no, it's not. And so you're very, very correct about looking carefully at the type of carbohydrates that you are, in fact, consuming.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
The more complex carbohydrates, the things that take longer internally to be broken down, are less likely to be quickly converted to sugar. So this is where the, you know, the multi-grain bread as opposed to the white bread can make a difference.
And this is another one of those cases where getting good high levels of fiber in your diet are beneficial.
That's exactly right.
Well, again, we have questions, time for one, or certainly maybe a couple questions here. If you want to call us real quick, 333-WILL or 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Anything we've been talking a lot about, and it's a good subject, we've been talking a lot about diabetes. Any other thing you just would want to make sure that we'd mention? Is there?
Well, in this society, basically the United States, cardiovascular disease still remains the number one cause of morbidity and mortality for both men and women. And, you know, people think of, gee, you know, I inherited a bad heart. Well, people generally don't inherit a bad heart. They may inherit tendencies toward high blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, obesity. All of those factors combined ultimately produce somebody's cardiovascular risk. And so all of those factors really need to be looked at for each individual as they get older. And those are things that should periodically be checked when you see your family doctor.
All right. To Champaign, here's a caller, line one. Hello.
Hi, Doc. This is Pat. I live in Champaign. My wife has hypoglycemia. And she can generally manage it very well. She's a very athletic person, and almost all throughout the year she can handle it just by diet. But there are maybe a month out of the year where maybe due to stress from work, she's becomes unable to manage her hypoglycemia. Like she'll eat food, and her blood sugar will spike, and then it will drop precipitously, and then she'll feel very ill, and then she'll eat again, and it'll spike. And she goes through these cycles every day until, at some point, it becomes manageable. What is something she can do to either further diagnose her issue or bring that further under control?
The problem with individuals who, in some respects, perhaps have very active insulin responses is that, as you point out, if they eat something that rapidly gets into their bloodstream and causes their sugar to go up, if the response from the body is that the insulin rapidly brings it back down and, in fact, overshoots how far it should bring it down, then you're going to feel bad at the bottom end of your blood sugar range. And in most instances for individuals who have this tendency, the key is, as you alluded to, is dietary management, which is don't eat three large meals spaced a long period of a long time apart. But this is typically where we're telling people you need to be eating every couple of hours, but it needs to be the complex carbohydrates, more proteins, things that will, in terms of generating an insulin response, create not a spike and drop, but a more sustained normal blood sugar. And in the vast majority of individuals, that'll take care of it. There are a few sort of rare cases where people actually have a problem with their insulin. And there are some sort of sophisticated tests to look at insulin levels in response to blood sugars that can be done if there's concern that dietary management alone isn't going to take care of it.
Is she at risk for diabetes?
No, actually, for some reason, that's kind of one of those old wives' tales that people who have problems with blood sugars being low, that they're in some respects going to be at higher risk for diabetes, but that is really not the case.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So we're just about the point we have to finish up here. One thing we haven't really talked about is allergies. Are we're really coming into what it's going to, maybe we already enter big time, the other big peak of the
hay
of the
fever
season.
Hay fever is going to start right about now.
Right about now?
Yep.
Any general other than
go to Arizona.
Go to where there's no pollen. Well, okay, you can't do that. And then otherwise, you pretty much got to treat your symptoms. And
the folks who can take oral antihistamines, who can use the nasal steroid sprays, this is a definite time to get on those and use them regularly. A few patients will also benefit from a seasonal cortisone injection. And if that's something that you haven't discussed with your physician, is not an unreasonable thing to think about, as long as you don't have any other medical reasons not to consider it.
Mm. And does it really matter that you know specifically what it is that you're reacting to, as long as you
if you can avoid it?
Well, so in that case, say if you're allergic to cats, well, you know, I'm going to hang out with cats. But if it's something that is that follows that seasonal pattern, and you can pretty much figure that's it's something outside, and it's something in nature, and it's something that you can't do nothing about unless you move to Arizona.
Right.
Does it really matter?
No. Because the initial treatment's always going to be the same.
Mm. Okay. So stay hydrated, and you wear your sunscreen. And what else are we going to nag people about here before we go?
Eat your vegetables.
Eat your vegetables. Well, yeah, eat your vegetables and your whole grain bread, and you'll be in better shape. And go out for a walk. But not
every day.
Not in the heat of the day.
But not in the heat of the day.
All right. Jeff Swearingen is our guest. He's a family medicine doctor at Carl in Urbana. Every other month he is here on a Monday to talk with us. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, David.